Greetings, everyone. Welcome to this week's Coffee with Digital Trailblazers. We're just going to give a few seconds for everybody to join here on this August 15th, 2025, our 138th episode. And this one is going to be a very special one. I'm very excited for what we'll be covering today. And just give everybody a few seconds to join. Let me see, why is it doing this? So weird. LinkedIn, come on, why is it showing the Zoom screen underneath it? I don't know why. Does everybody else see that, or is it just me?
Yeah, I see it behind it. The window is narrower from a width perspective.
Yeah, it's strange. I was just telling our new guests today that it's always interesting on LinkedIn. The way it handles things, and I don't know what the reason is. We do have a group here, so we will officially get started in just a second. Welcome to this week's episode, and thank you for joining. Today, we'll be talking about one of our key topics on the AI era transformation, and I've chosen two areas where there's a lot of jargon and a lot of hype. One of them is the difference between AI agents and agentic AI, which you have to do a little bit of digging in to see what the real differences are. And those of us who write about it and work around it, or work through it, understand the differences a little bit differently. And I'm excited to have Joanne here with us, who first, honestly, Joanne, you were the first person who pointed out to me at a episode about 2 or 3 months ago, there are differences between AI agents and agentic AI. And so we will cover that in our first question. And our second question will be about large and small language models. And again, Joanne was the first person who introduced me. Hey, there's this thing called language models that don't have to be one size fits all. And there are reasons organizations are going to invest in small language models to improve accuracy and efficiency and speed. And we'll be talking about that as a second question today. And then our third area that we'll cover is around ChatGPT today, around ChatGPT 5.0, which just, I think it's over the last week, week and a half, it first came out. The reviews are in, they're not stellar. There's an article in this week's Wall Street Journal about the organization having to backtrack with their subscribers on some of the early capabilities or lack thereof of 5.0. And this is now 2 years after OpenAI first promised it. And so I thought it would be fitting to cover this in this conversation about where AI is heading with AI agents, agentic AI, large and small language models. And I'm happy to be discussing this with three experts today. They are Joanne and her co-founders, Matthew and Matthew. I'll let them introduce themselves to you. They're here as special guests, and they are here to talk a little bit about their big announcement around Real AI, their startup that they are just launching. And when we get to the mid break, we'll talk more about what they're doing around Real AI and what their product is and what their objectives are as a startup. And Joanne, I'm really, really excited to hear about this from you when we get to our mid session break. But for getting started today, I just want you to level set with us. What is the difference between I'm going to start with language models. It's like, what is the difference between small and large language models? And let's talk about some of the use cases where you see organizations using small language models. Joanne, welcome to the floor.
Thank you, Isaac, as always. It's great to be here amongst the crew. Thanks for joining everybody. It is a special day for us, and I'm really excited to introduce you to my co-founder, Matthew Fissler, and our principal architect at Real AI. Commonly called Fundy, because he's also a Matthew. So to differentiate the two, Fundy goes by Fundy, but his real name is Matthew Funderburg. The difference between a large language model and a small language model, think about an ocean and think about a bucket. That's large, that's small. And you can boil the ocean to try and get the information that you want, or you can fill a bucket, as we like to say, data on tap, whether it's a bucket or a beer stein or a glass or a small pond, you're distilling information into something that's manageable and usable, but directed purposefully and directed for an outcome, meaning not only the purpose of that particular agent, but also an outcome that needs to be achieved in a business. And the other thing that you want to remember about the bucket size is that it's specialized. It might have information that it's been trained on that is relevant to a CFO versus a CTO, a manufacturer versus a retailer, or a bakery. They're specialized, they're succinct, they have less verbiage that they're being trained on, so they react differently to them. They're able to absorb information in a different way. They can create better context. So it's boil the ocean to get an answer, which is what takes the time in the ChatGPTs and the large language models. And they're very good at creative things. They're very good at, wrapping capabilities. They do a great job from the creative side. But if you want an outcome to be achieved, a small language model gets you a lot farther, a lot faster for two reasons. Agents can be choreographed, meaning that they can be coordinated and you can use them together and build one upon another, kind of like you do with Lego. And they're specialized. And so, because they're specialized, you can use personalization. Joe would want a different model than you would want. I would want a different model than John would want because our roles are different, our vernaculars are different. So a small language model being specialized to suit us, almost to the point of being very personalized in the way the models are trained, have great advantages. And there's a lot of use cases that I can cite you.
So, Joanne, I have this picture in my mind that if I'm building a language model or an agent for customer support in a retail organization with lots and lots of SKUs and lots of product, I may be veering off to specializing a large language model with a RAG, retrieval augmented generation, put my content accessible to a large language model. And that might be my option over there. But if I'm working in radiology and image interpretation for radiologists, maybe I want to be working with a small language model. Is that a good sort of way of
That would
bookending?
be, it's a good bookending. I agree with you, but I would say one thing also. That retailer and all those product SKUs, they may want to have a small language model that is geared towards making them more effective and more cost efficient because it also talks to their supply chain systems or their distributors or their textile manufacturers. And you can create a small language model that would be usable for that specific type of industry, meaning I'm a women's fashion retailer or whatever. That would be a very good example of another
Interesting.
small language model. And think of them in terms of processes as well, right? Supply chain management has a lot of different aspects to it. Manufacturing has a lot of different aspects. Construction, all of the various industries, we've always lived with IT systems that are designed to be used by almost anyone. Think about IT systems that are now being built out of agentic AI that are designed to have very specific focus to get you where you're trying to go a lot faster and a lot more efficiently.
So you can see I'm starting a box here, Joanne, about like some of the decision factors. You're saying even though my domain might be very specialized or very broad, like my retailer, I'm looking at sort of the ratio of how much domain knowledge there is versus what a large language model might hold. And if I have a significant amount of domain knowledge, even though it's a lot, and a large language model might cover it, I still might want to look at a small model because of all that context it's going to bring to it. And a second one you brought up is areas of cost and skills, right? Cost going to be cheaper for me to run my small language models, cheaper for me to train my small language model, but I need potentially more skills to be able to develop something like that. Is that couple of the factors there I need to consider?
Yes, and you should also consider that some of the resource that you would use to build a small language model might be sitting down the hall in an office and has a lot of what we call tribal knowledge, in no disrespectful way, meaning tribal, but the institutional knowledge. People have a lot of that in their heads, and it never gets documented, it never gets captured in any way, it's not curated in any way, but it can be the biggest difference in the world to how successful the company is. So you need to talk to your workforce just as much as you need to look at, taxonomies or ontologies or industry reports or documentation. Ask people, have them contribute to it, because there's a wealth of knowledge that's never been used, but really will excel as a resource for small language models and for people who are trying to get from here to there, meaning they have a very defined set of goals, they have a very defined set of outcomes that they want to achieve.
Can I just take a pause here? I'm looking at the comment stream. I'm seeing a couple people having audio issues. If you are having an audio issue, can you just leave a comment? And if you're hearing just fine, just leave a comment. Just want to make sure we clear that up to the best that we can. But it sounds like the issue is resolved. Liz, just keep monitoring that. We'll bring you on after our two Matts chime in. Let's go with Fundy first. Fundy, welcome to the floor. We're talking about large and small language models. What can you tell us about those architecture decisions you have when you start thinking about your domain and problem that you're solving with a language model? How to pick which approach is most appropriate?
That's a great question. And just make sure you can hear me okay, right? Just
We
double
can hear
checking.
you. Yep, we
Great,
hear you.
great. So in my thought, it is about the orchestration from a, I'm not going to go too deep in the technical, but I firmly have a strong design process of there's no limitation to what type of large language or small language that can be to your advantage. So that's been always the architectural perspective that I've taken when trying to make sure that I can do, specific domains or a multitude of domains to come back to the orchestration to give better decision making and better, say, reasoning, I should say, for launching, these AI agents that, that are small to do a singular purpose and then be able to reach out to the larger language to help with reasoning, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. So when you're looking at a type of problem and you're saying, where do I start from in terms of building up a language model to solve for it? What is your thinking steps and how do you get started with that?
So, my thought has been you may have your custom LLMs, but you can also take advantage of all the open source or the ones that are proprietary if you decide to use those and make them part of the layer, I should say, of those decision making processes. If I'm sorry.
Yep. I think Matt is back. I think he dropped and joined us by phone. Matt, are you still here?
I'm still here. I'll have to apologize. I had audio. I rebooted the computer, so I missed the question. So, for continuity, we'll just move on.
No. Jump in here. We're just talking about the decision process of when to use a small versus a large language model. Or how to think about them differently when you're a sponsor on on an AI program. There's this sort of the way we write about them and speak about them, the way the press shows them, and certainly the way the OpenAIs and the Anthropics are showing this is like you have a choice of four or five very large language models to choose from, and go down lane 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 and experiment with the five of us, and that's where you're going to be your base. And I'm hearing, well, there's door number six that talks about, maybe you're not using those five, maybe you're building a smaller language model specific to your domain. And I want to give our audience a sense of how we think about making those decisions, whether you're using one of the five or which one of the five. And I'm, by the way, I don't even know if there are five. There's probably more than that. And the small language models that you can go out and potentially build on your own. Do you have some guidelines around that?
So I believe you use the correct one. It's going to be a combination of all the above. The benefit of your specialized or your small language is you can really focus them in on an engineering process or a specific thing you're looking at. And the other thing to consider is the context you're putting around why you're looking. The CFO might look at the data in a different way than a controls person might. So you have to put that in context, and then you need a decision engine to say, this individual is looking for this for a given or a specific reason. And then that reasoning then pipes into the models that you're approaching. So instead of taking the ocean, as Joanne mentioned, boiling it, it's really being very specific and directed at those models. And that's kind of how I look at it.
Got it. So we are actually back to that idea of orchestration, and we're going to be using models in different ways. In some cases, they're going to be very specific to solving a very contextual problem, a very domain-oriented problems. Other times, they're going to be more generic. And part of our training is building this decision engine that you're describing. Let's bring John in. John, what's your experience with large and small language models?
Yeah, Isaac. Hey, thanks for having me up. My experience on this is I have was at a company where we spent a lot of time trying to use public language models to solve business problems. And then personally, I've gotten some of the smaller language models just to run locally entirely on my computer. So we're not using anything else outside of the stuff that was running on my computer. And the thing that I just think back to when we were working on projects for companies is that we were using published language models that were trained on every piece of data that they were able to get, and some of that was sourced legitimately, but they really scraped everything they could publicly find on movies, books, the internet. Was we were really working hard to get the answers that it was providing to be relevant to what the use case of the business application, and we had to put a lot of work in to have guardrails on that, so it wasn't answering things inappropriately or wrong or things like that, because it's like the whole internet is in there, and you could get response. It's really trained on all sorts of stuff. Some of it's true, some of it's untrue, and the largest model is GPT-5. It has parameters in the number of trillions. And it can be really hard to put enough guardrails on that to answer it in ways that are professional and appropriate, because it's trained with all the bad stuff on the internet too. The smaller language models, like if it's really going the other way, if you give it very specific data, you'll have so much more control at the end of what comes out of it when you're interacting with it. And so that's the thing that really comes to my mind is that if you really need to have control of how that thing's interacting with users, and you want to make sure it's not saying anything inappropriate, you want as much control of it as you can. And then the last thing I was going to say is when you're using the public models, they change over time, and we would be getting an answer that would be good for a customer, and then they would. There's definitely the language model, and then there's a layer above it that's basically a chatbot, which controls the answers. Sometimes it would stop responding to the things that we were wanting. We did a project for one of the counties, and we were working to be basically providing answers for things. And one of the answers was about actually the coroner's office, and it was like, how do I get my loved one that's passed away back after they've done the investigation of the death. And the public language models were actually saying that's inappropriate and we can't discuss it. But we actually had to work with them to have appropriate answers on how to respond to that in a way that was, this is a process after your loved ones passed away that we can get the body to the to over to the home for into the cemetery. And so that's, if you want the control, you really have to go to something that you have control of in a small language model.
John, your answer is fascinating because it almost suggests why would you ever want to use a large language model anytime you're
Yes.
dealing with human safety or anytime
Yeah.
where your decisions can't be impacted by irrelevant or damaging contexts that are already plugged into a large language model.
Yeah, and it's amazing what you can do with a model. Like, so ChatGPT 5, it probably has 5 to 17 trillion parameters, and I had models running on my machines that were in the 7 billion parameters, and those things, have about 1,000 less parameters. They're so much smaller, and even the answers of those were amazing, and those were still large language models, and you can get it so much more efficient if you get out all the information that's not relevant.
John, can you give us like a 60-second drive-by of how you are developing a multi-billion node model on your machine? Like, what does this look like when you're building
Oh,
it?
no, I didn't do that. There actually is all sorts of models out there that other people trained that you can run on your machines. And so this one was a Lambda model that they made a version of it called Alpaca, which they quantized the basically the model so that it's basically compressing it so that it doesn't take so much memory to run. So they're able to get this thing just small enough to run on like a MacBook.
Got it. And then are you just using it natively or are you also
Yeah.
giving it your own context on top of it?
No, I was just using that
Using it
natively
natively.
because we wanted to have a language model run locally without connected to the internet.
Neat. Neat. I need to see how you did that one day. That's a very cool story. Joanne, I'm going to let you get the last word here on language models and then the first word here on AI agents. Go ahead, Joanne.
Okay. So on language models, first of all, they come in different flavors, meaning in English, French, and a variety of other languages. Sometimes you will also find two things: inherent bias in a large language model that has been translated from something else. So if it wasn't an English-made model and now has been translated, if you read carefully the answers of the large language models, they get like halfway through and then the context completely changes. And this is something that I've noticed in the latest in ChatGPT 5, where you can see where they did the scrape of the internet of, whatever, and got the nuance wrong in the translation. So it's not quite a hallucination, it's a translation error. But it skews and creates bias in a way that people don't expect. The other thing about large language models is that when you're boiling the ocean, to John's point, you don't only open the door to disinformation and misinformation, but your security issues are much greater because the attack can come from so many different sources. In a small language model, you have much more control over the data sources that you're using. You can decide which ones you want, particularly for internal use. An ERP, an SEM, PLM, any of the back office systems, you can bridge the gap as we have between OT, operational technologies, and IT, informational technologies, and use one as context around the other through RAGing. There's a lot of different ways. The opportunities are expansive for small language models. The opportunities with large language models, I find personally, are a little bit more limited. It's not that you can't find everything under the sun. Don't misunderstand. It's just that the risks, the costs, and the overhead of trying to get to the right answer, the exact answer that you want, is a lot harder. Because you have to double check everything that it's coming back to you with. So if it comes back with, a very long answer and you have to start taking that apart and fact checking all of it, it can take time. And that's another sort of hidden cost of the large language models. To Matt's point, Matthew Fissler's point, one of the things that we tried to do is to be very agnostic to which large language model you wanted to use for part of the platform that we've designed. And the reason for that is because there's math, there's physics, there's large language models, there's so many different varieties. Choose the language model, big or small, that answers the question most directly. And to your fascination with the MacBook, let me point you in the direction of someone who's doing it on a smartphone and has actual models running on their phone.
Yeah, it's crazy to me. By the way, there's a really rich comment stream going on here on LinkedIn right now. I am remote today, so I don't have my multi-screen set up, and it's hard for me to monitor. But some great comments here around Hugging Face from Vaibhav and from Steve on using language models for specific tasks. Keep it coming. I think I'm going to include this in my blog post around it. So even though I don't have it being cutting and pasting in our dashboard here, Joanne, we will find a way to get this published. Joanne, let's just jump right also into agents and agentic AI. I give you credit for being the first person to say they mean different things. Obviously, with there's some overlap and related to them. I remember I saw my first agent demo with Joe Puglisi, who is here. Joe, I want you to comment on this as well. But we watched really orchestrated agents speaking to each other. I translated what I saw in an agent as imagine having an API over a series of microservices that represent a bunch of different workflows in the context of getting a job done. And now instead of programming them with JSON, I'm interfacing them with English. They're having or language, natural language. They're having a conversation, a self-organizing conversation to help solve my problem. So agent-to-agent communication's happening. And that was my first example around what AI agents were all about. I was kind of fascinated by the replacement of JSON with English, with the focus on roles instead of just microservice automations, low-level automations, and obviously very fascinating by the orchestration of conversation between agents. And then we leaped into this discussion around what agentic AI is becoming, which is it has got elements of a reasoning agent that's involved with it. It's more autonomous. There's more feedback built into it. And that was my understanding of AI agents versus agentic AI. Joanne, I want to give you the first crack at this. Enlighten the rest of us. What am I missing beyond this that makes agentic AI so interesting?
Autonomy is one thing. Now, I will tell you that autonomy is something that we have looked at very deeply and very long and hard. And I would say the biggest difference is to think of an agent, a true agentic AI, meaning not AI agents, but agentic AI, is four things: sense, detect, learn, act, or act, learn. I'm sorry, I got that backwards. So they sense their environment, they detect information, they learn as they're going, and they're constantly improving, and they act. They can act all by themselves. You can use an agent to say, fire off an email to Isaac talking about this episode, or go mine data in an ERP and add that to contextualize the conversation I'm having with you in that email about, you didn't get paid for an invoice, I didn't get paid for an invoice, some transactional matter. They sense their environment. So it's an agent that's going to go against the email. It's going to have capability of drafting that email, but it's also going to go grab information from the back office system. So it's sensing and detecting because you've told it, go to the ERP and detect based on an API and other information, the programmatics, what you want, what you need, and bring it back to me in that email. Then it's learning that this is the right thing for it to be doing based on the programmatics, that have been put in, and the logic and the reasoning, and it's acting on its own, of its own volition. Now, you may have given it permission to run completely autonomously, or as we've done in our case, because trust is a five-letter word, if you don't 100% trust it, you can also create human-in-the-loop guardrails. You can't quite get from here to there with AI agents. They work differently. They have different mechanisms. You can use them as wrappers around other systems, right? To make them more like an HMI, the human-machine interface that we've all wanted to have for years and years. So it's not the dog wagging its tail, it's the tail wagging its dog, because every UI that's ever been created has not been created for you personally, or Joe, or Matt, or Fundy, or me. It's been created for a mass population, and we've all had to tweak it. We've all had to live with things that we don't like about it. But an agent can bring context to the conversation. An AI agent may give you that human machine interface, that NLP way of talking to it, way of doing other, a text mode, or uploading a video to it, or an image, and it'll interpret that. But really, it's not an agent. It's not able to go do its own thing on its own. It's not sensing its environment. It's being directed. It's being orchestrated. There's pipelines. In agentic AI, you, through what you described earlier, agents talking to each other, they can collaborate. They can be layered. They can be swarmed and run in parallel. So you can have an agent that's going to that ERP, an agent that's going to that email, an agent that's looking up what's the voice of Isaac when he writes these emails for context, and the situational awareness of what is actually being done in this transactional email. All of those various things are features and functions of agentic AI. They're not features and functions of AI wrappers or AI agents. Now, there are those that have tried to go down that road, and there's nothing wrong with that. We all have to experiment. Some have been very successful, but those that are driven towards outcome and solving business problems are on the agentic AI side, not on the AI agent side. Sorry for the very long explanation.
Wow, there's a lot there to unpack, and I'm excited to hear what Matt and Fundy have to say about this. But I do want to take my mid-session break, folks. Thank you for joining this week's Coffee with Digital Trailblazers. We got a really good crowd here. We've got a great comment stream here. A lot of people interested on small versus large language models, agents versus agentic AI. But I have to say, what I'm most excited about this episode is giving the mic over to Joanne Friedman and her team, Matt and Fundy, who are here joining us today. Joanne, you've been working on your startup for some time. I want to hear a little bit more about the history behind Real AI, what problems you're solving for, what your product looks like today. Give us the lowdown. This is a conversation around AI. Perfect time for you to come out and tell us all about the interesting things that you and Matt and Fundy are doing with your startup.
Thank you, Isaac, for the opportunity and for having us all here this morning. I'm Joanne Friedman. If you're a regular listener, you know I've been here for what, 138 episodes. You must be tired of hearing from me. Matthew Fisler, who's on this call, and Fundy, who's actually Matthew Funderburg, and we differentiate them just so that I can keep their name straight of who I'm talking to. Fundy and Matt and I really started, Matthew and I should say, co-founded Real AI last year. We've been moving at lightning speed. Fundy did some work for us before we were actually even a corporation, and we've now made him employee number one. Woohoo! And I'm so happy that he's joined us, because he's a very brilliant principal architect, and we're very lucky to have him. And what we're doing is this. So both Matthew Fissler and I have spent many decades in manufacturing. And so, one of the things that we both realized when we came together to form the corporation is that we saw the same problems over and over again, regardless of what industry sector, whether it was manufacturing or not manufacturing. Companies are hoarders, they're data hoarders. They collect data like there's no tomorrow. It's all sitting in clouds. It's all sitting all over, data centers, enterprise data centers or not, or it's been outsourced. And then they wonder, why can't they ever find anything? And why can't they ever find anything that's really valuable? So there's two issues. One is, let's stop playing where in the world is Waldo with our data. And the other problem is, what value is it really driving? I mean, if you look, we're collecting huge trillions of dollars worth of data. We're using maybe 3 or 4% of it at the best. So here's what was keeping me up at night, and to a certain extent, Matt as well, which is it's not just the data disaster of disconnected systems or where in the world is my data or, I can't get this system to talk to that system and all of that kind of thing. It's also that your best engineers, whether you're in IT or OT or in the business, the best engineers are retiring next month. Your tribal knowledge is disappearing. It's walking out the door Friday at 5. So long, farewell, because so many people are retiring. And your data is still lost. You don't know how to find it. It's trapped in systems that were designed when, I don't know, maybe a flip phone was a cutting-edge technology. And in the midst of all of this chaos, the board is asking you about AI. Your boss is asking you about ROI, and you're showing them chatbots or maybe GPT-5, which leaves a little bit to be desired. And I know that's one of Isaac's questions, but it's great. And that's great for some things, but it's not good for outcomes to be achieved. Not in a supply chain, not in manufacturing, not where there's complex situations. Not where you want an outcome. So I knew we could do better. Matt knew we could do better. So we came together and founded Real AI. And that was about 7 months ago. And we've created something that's basically very different. It's autonomous agents that actually work. No chatbots, no fancy marketing, not another wrapper around GPT or, any of the other large language models. These are real agents that learn your business like craftsmen, earning their mastery. They are released in the vernacular of trades as apprentices. In other words, they know a lot, but they're inexperienced. And they learn your systems as they go. And we progress them using human in the loop and governance and all of the guardrails that would be necessary to help you learn to trust AI in a way of like you come in as an apprentice, you learn a lot, you become a journeyman. After you become a journeyman and get a license, then you're a master. And we put the control of autonomy in the hands of our customers. We're not forcing anybody to do anything. Which a lot of other companies that are coming out in the agentic space are. If you don't have human in the loop, you have a level of opt-in. If you want these agents to run completely autonomously, you can. They're built that way, they're designed that way. But we felt that it's going to be a while before people actually trust them. So let's give you the best of both worlds with the opt-ins and the guardrails that diminish over time. And when you're ready, that's when you say, flip the switch, let's make them autonomous, because we've run them so many times that we know we get a predictable result. And that's the way it really should be. So that's one of the things that makes us a little bit different, is that we are big on making sure that you trust what we're doing and we help you through it. The second thing about it is that our agents, as I said earlier, sense, detect, act, learn in that continuous loop. They don't just answer questions. They actually capture knowledge, they choreograph workflows, and they turn trapped data into revenue-generating products. We have a process called data productization that we help our customers with. And what that does is actually transform what would be siloed or underused, underutilized data that's been sitting around for a long time that may actually have a lot of value to it into a data product that they can resell or a process that they can leverage for their competitive advantage or define their own small language models and sell those as a product. In other words, we're looking at top line value, not just the efficiencies that can be gained by having agents running across the shop floor in a manufacturing environment to give you your OEE or your FMEA, any of those kind of process things. We're model driven, we're big on process, and our choreographies and orchestrations of our agents follow business processes. They follow standard business processes. So you can use them across facilities, whether you're one shop or 10 shops, it doesn't matter. So they're designed for day-to-day use. They're not fancy in the sense of look and feel. The UI is basically a natural language processing engine. They're designed to provide value at the top line, at the bottom line, and across your ecosystem.
Joanne, that sounds fantastic. Can you share for our listening audience the URL to your website so they can go and find
Yeah, I
you?
was just about to do that. Thank you for reminding me. We're this call this our unofficial soft launch. Join us next Thursday. We'll give you a time. If you go to the website, you can fill in the form and we'll send you back exactly what time because we'll run the calls at different times on Zoom. But it's realai.com. It's REILAI.com. And you can begin to learn about what we're doing and what the products is going to look like. There are some screenshots there of what the UI and how it works. There's some case studies that'll be put up over the next couple of days and some partner announcements that we're going to be making. And I think you'll be a bit surprised. There's some big folks, big companies that have put their confidence in us. They're supporting us in a lot of different ways. We thank them for it. They were early believers. And the truth of the matter is, it's a revolution that's going to happen with AI. You can either lead it or you can follow it. We try to be leaders, and we hope you'll join us because we think we can show you real competitive advantage.
Thank you, Joanne. 138 e episodes here with us at the Coffee with Digital Trailblazers. We've been talking about AI for be even before the LLMs were coming out, and I'm super excited to see what you're doing and what you will be doing with Real AI. I want to bring Fundy and Matt back. There are a few words here that you used in describing agentic AI and describing what you're doing with Real AI that they seem to have some conflicting messages to our audience. And in general, I would say, this idea of ACT, autonomy for agentic AI, but then, this notion of human in the middle, and in some cases, human at the helm, right? And so when I hear autonomous, can I have an autonomous agentic AI system, but still have human in the middle, or are these two different things? I guess that's how I would phrase my question. Fundy, do you want to try that? Fundy, you're on mute.
Yeah, that's a lot to digest and process for me to think through it. Sorry about that.
My question is, can you are autonomous agentic AI systems and human in the middle agentic systems, are those two different things? Or can you have an autonomous system still have human in the loop as part of its charter?
yeah, I believe you can. To me, it's depending on the layers that you're using. For me, and some of the system designing that I've been doing is looking at tiers in my design work, and then also using a method of layers, without giving too much away to for that process. So I absolutely think you can do it. Yeah.
Matt, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, so with on the tiers and the layers, autonomous and human in a loop can absolutely run together. It's just when you do that autonomy, you need those constant checks and that constant feedback and a way to intervene. And the way that we've developed the system is we have a special process that we can go through and target and listen and understand. And we have the gates from the apprentice to the master, but you have to look at it as a headless nature in modules because the system is learning. And if through its autonomy it makes an error, then you have an option to jettison that module, stop that module, stop that process, and rework it again. So you have to be really careful when you get to that autonomy level, but that's what we have been designing, testing, and working through right now.
Thanks, Matt and Fundy. Joe, we haven't heard from you today. I want to bring you into the conversation. You can go talk about real AI and what you're hearing about what Joanne's working on, about agents, agentic AI. What you learned out at HMG out in Philly. What do you have for us on AI today, Joe?
Let me say take three things in quick sequence. I don't want to burn too much time. First of all, congratulations, Joanne. This sounds incredible, impressive, and I particularly like the way in which you characterized your agents as being apprentice and learning the trade. Brilliant metaphor. Second, as we talk about these earlier, the large language model versus the small language model, in my head, and I'd love to get both Matt's opinions on this, as well as Joanne's opinion on this. In my head, I see a continuum from left to right. I put down high school student and PhD. So you have sort of a range of educational and life experience, right? And then from bottom to top, very narrow focus on let's call it the domain knowledge. And then at the top would be very broad knowledge of domain knowledge. And I started to think about when you hire somebody for a job or you want to spin up an agent, what knowledge or data is necessary to achieve what business outcome? And so in my head, there's not a dichotomy of just small language models versus large language models, but I really see it as a continuum of how much data is necessary, how much focus do you want in order to achieve a specific business outcome. And you know, I always put the B before the T. In this particular case, talking about agents, I want to know what is the agent going to do for me? What is the business function it's going to fulfill? And therefore, how smart does it have to be? How much data does it have to have? The last thing I want to do is go back to your comment earlier about what we saw in a demonstration last year, Isaac. The one thing that blew me away about the mesh or network of agents that we saw demonstrated was the interaction, as you mentioned. They're not using JSON, they're using English. And what struck me about that as I reflected on it, is that it fits my model. It says I can insert into this mesh of agents, of digital agents, a human and augment the agents by having a human in there who has specific domain knowledge or experience that's relevant, and allow that individual to interact and perhaps provide guidance to these agents. So those were just a couple of the thoughts, and thank you for giving me a few minutes to express them.
I'm going to let either Joanne or Matt or Fundy answer your question about how you're thinking about it because I think it's interesting. Who wants to jump in here? Joanne?
Sure. That's what we envisioned, and that's exactly what we built. Your matrix. No, but it is a continuum. As a matter of fact, there's a slide that we have, and I believe it may or may not yet be on the website, but there's a continuum between agentic AI, sorry, between generative AI and agentic AI, and then intelligent data on tap, which is our platform and our solution suite. And that's exactly what was in my head when I started doing the design. That's what we're building, and that's exactly the reason. It's what is going to get me the answers that I need to make the best decisions possible in the context and with the relevance, and how much domain expertise do I need, how much general expertise do I need, and how do I also incentivize and incite the workforce around me to contribute to my knowledge management, to my knowledge system, because the more informed that knowledge base is, and knowledge bases are really the foundation and cornerstones, or even Rosetta stones, of small language models, and in our case, much of our system, to give you that insight. As the agents keep learning, they keep going from the high school student farther down the road towards the PhD, because the PhD wants to have as much knowledge as possible, but in very specific ways, very detailed ways, to make better decisions and have better outcomes.
Joanne, I have a lot of questions around PhD AIs. I'm going to leave that for another conversation around AI. PhDs for me imply the ability to research and come up with solutions and expressions that are based on research, based on solutioning and experimenting. And this is sounding almost AGI-ish. And I and
Join us on Thursday, Isaac, because I think we might just Fundy in particular might blow your mind. And I don't say that lightly, because it's a very smart mind that you have. But yeah, that's exactly it. They our agents do reason, they do provide insight, they are constantly learning. And if you think about a learning system, you can flip that on its head and call it a learning management system and use it to train new employees that are onboarding. You can also use it to capture the knowledge of that workforce that's about to retire and walk out the door Friday night at five that you'll never see again. And it's a way to bring knowledge back into the corporation that may have gotten lost in the chaos of the data mess that's out there.
got it. I want to bring John and Liz in. They're both raising their hands. We've
Sure.
got 7 minutes left. John, what do you have for us?
When I think of the difference between an agent versus agentic, to me, the agents are worker bees, and the agentic is really has executive functions. And when you go to think about these, HAL 9000 to me is the original, the OG agentic AI, because it makes decisions, it chooses priorities and all these things that even if the humans are in conflict with it still decides to go its own way. I also just dropped a link in. There's a really neat study that was done, but basically Anthropic studied 16 different models just to see how they would behave when they really got put in corners, and 96% of the time they're able to try to get it to blackmail the humans, and it's really fascinating. So I think it's really important to have humans in the loop. You can put humans in the loop on the priorities, and you can put humans on the loops on the decisions that it chooses to do, and then you can put humans on the loop on the actions. And a couple of years ago, I was playing with Baby AGI. That's one of the earlier kind of AI agents, and it's by a guy named Yokei Jama, Yokehi Nakajima, and that's his GitHub repo. And you basically give it the goals, so it's an agent, but it'll basically do OODA loops. To continuously iterate on that, and you could say, "Hey, book me tickets to somewhere," and it would find the place. It would like ask you for your credit card. It would book things. It's really impressive what they can do. So, you have to have humans in the loop until you really trust these things.
Again, it leads me to a bunch of questions, John, maybe for a future episode, but I think we need some way of creating transparency around what an autonomous agent is empowered to do. And I'm hearing some vernaculars from Joanne in terms of thinking about an apprentice versus a master. And that might be a way of cataloging things to make to build trust. But I think that needs to be regulated, and maybe we'll just bring that to another conversation one day. Go ahead, Joanne, and let's give Liz a
I
chance.
just wanted to address your concern. We had the same concern. That's why we use role-based authentication and attribute-based authentication, not only for security, but to make sure that only I don't want to say only the right people see the right information, but that even when the agents are doing their work, that you can not only see it, but it's explainable, it's traceable, it's auditable, et cetera, because we had the same concerns.
Yeah, and then you think about agents partnering with people in the enterprise, and the decision authorities in the enterprise with people aren't well documented. Now we're going to have our agents take over some of those things. It's almost sounds like if we don't do this well, it will be the inmates running the asylum. And I applaud how you're thinking about running these things and creating transparency. And your focus on trades. I think it's just a very interesting space, one that's well needed. I want to bring Liz here to chime in, and Joanne, I'll give you the last word before we close
Yeah,
out.
thanks. Thanks, Isaac. I think that this is a fabulous, fabulous opportunity, and I'm so excited for your new company, Real AI. And it brings up so many interesting leaps forward. And at the same time, given that I am also business first and also sort of focused on organizational change, and this is probably for a whole different topic, selling this to executives and saying humans in the loop and saying talking about absorbing data that's or information that's leaking from tribal knowledge or institutional knowledge or walking out the door, all those are amazing things for the company. I'm wondering how that's actually going to integrate with the actual organization itself and how it's going to impact the culture of the organization and how people will embrace that. It's almost a whole different topic. But I can tell you, having worked on technology leaps in the transportation, specifically with Amtrak, and how that conflicted with even some perception of conflict with the unions, there were some very interesting reactions. So, for another call, I'm sure. I don't disagree with you that it can change the culture. We're trying to do it in a way that's positive and friction-free so that people will be rewarded for their efforts, whether it's in terms of upskilling or upscaling or however the corporation chooses to use it. We're providing them the means to help people adapt to this new era, even to the point of, this is a dual use technology for those that may be in the audience that have anything to do with government. We did a case study for the federal government in the US, and we were looking at the transition rates between people leaving military and going to civilian life and how we could help them. So if you had a particular job in the military and then you were, or armed services, I should say, and were transitioning, could you use this tool for that purpose? And we actually had very good response from it because it's a learning curve that allows people to move from one environment to the other. So this is how I think cultural shifts are going to change. It won't be as dramatic as with the ChatGPT because of the time that the large language models have been out, but it is dramatic in the sense of, oh, it's very cool for me to see that when I ask a question, I also get some insight and I'm encouraged to comment on it. I'm encouraged through my HR group or my management to put back into the system what I know. And if it's something that hasn't been looked at for 10 years, it may have no value, but in most cases, it actually, people are looking for it because it did have value and it got overlooked.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the idea of working a partnership with the workers and rewarding them for participation. It's fantastic.
Guys, what I love is my favorite coffee hours that we've had is when we have a healthy comment stream. Everybody's sharing questions on it. So I want to thank everybody for doing that. When I publish the whiteboard, I will include some of those comments in here. Thank you for all your insights and contributions today. And I love coming back and saying, hey, we've got three more things to cover around the topics that we brought up. PhD agents, regulations and transparency around autonomous agents, and agents changing the corporate culture, I think are three things we have to find a way to cover sometime here in the future. And Joanne, probably in 3 months' time, I'd love you to be another sponsor again for the coffee hour,
Absolutely.
to come back and chime and tell us what you're up to, your successes at rolling it out, and your marketing strategies, and some of the things that you're doing with your agents. Just very fascinating. Thank you, Matt and Fundy, for joining us today, telling us about what you're doing with Real AI. Folks, everybody, thank you for joining this week's Coffee with Digital Trailblazers. I'm going to leave you with two URLs, starcio.com/coffee/next-event. That will take you to our upcoming event when I set up the redirect. Our episode next week, also around AI, has a very special guest. We'll be talking about AI as a teammate, crafting purpose-filled digital workplaces. I'm really excited for that particular topic. The 29th will be taking off for Labor Day weekend. A second URL. If you want access to our previous recordings, do visit starcio.com/coffee. All of the episodes that are public are there. I just started putting them up as a podcast. You can actually listen to them now on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify Podcast engine. So the URLs for that are there. So do visit there. And then Joanne has shared the URL for her company, realai.com. Do I have that right, Joanne?
Yes, realai.com, REILAI.com.
Fascinating and awesome. I'm totally excited to hear about what you're doing in the future. We wish you all the success in rolling out your agents, and can't wait to hear your updates when we bring you back here to talk about Real AI in the future. Folks, everybody have a great weekend. Enjoy August. We'll be back here next week talking about AI as a teammate, crafting purposeful digital workplaces. Everybody have a great weekend.